And hello there, I'm Laura Lee. Thanks for tuning in to Conversation for Exploration. Greg Braden joins us tonight. He's the author of The Isaiah Effect, Decoding the Lost Science of Prayer and Prophecy, also Walking Between the Worlds and Awakening to Zero Point, the Collective Initiation. Greg has been a frequent guest on the show over the last 10 years, and he joins us to talk about the principles of unity underlying this collective group called the human race, and some interesting new insights and scientific research that he synthesized to shed some light on how we are all so deeply connected. Greg, welcome.
Well, good evening, Laura. It's a pleasure to hear your voice and certainly a joy to be on your program once again. And, you know, I guess I hadn't realized we have been doing this nearly 10 years now.
And we have indeed. It's been quite a journey.
It's been a wonderful journey.
Tell me about your overarching theme. You know, you do a lot of innovative research. You look into a lot of different areas. You travel a lot, talk to a lot of people. What is your mission? How do you define that?
You know, Laura, it's an interesting question. The guiding principle that leads us to the bodies of work and the research that we've done, actually the 15th year now since 1986, we've done this pretty much full time, is precisely what you stated in our introduction, that the principles of unity, the principles that bind us together as the family of humankind, and in doing so empower us to bring about change, to participate in the events within our bodies and in the events of our world as it unfolds before us in very life-affirming and empowering ways. Almost universally, ancient texts and traditions remind us in the language of their day that we're all connected, that we are related through, for lack of a better term, what the ancients called the web, the invisible web that binds all of creation. And coming from the world of the hard sciences, Laura, I can tell you in the language of our day and the colleagues that I've worked with in the industry, that when you begin speaking to a scientist about an invisible web that binds all of creation, you can see eyes glaze over. And
such an abstract concept to them, isn't it?
Well, sure. Up until recently, it really has not held a lot of meaning, and all that has changed. Now, within just the last 4 or 5 years, through a series of just outrageous experiments done in accredited academic and scientific institutions that are just shaking the foundations of Western science as we have seen it in the past. And it is in the basis of those experiments that we're now finding that we are, in fact, related through a fabric that appears to weave its way throughout creation of a previously unrecognized form of energy. And I said that very carefully.
Unrecognized form of energy. What are they calling it?
Unrecognized. I'm not saying that it's newly discovered, because I believe ancient and indigenous traditions were very aware of this form of energy, and in the language of their day did their best to describe it to us. And as a matter of fact, Laura, where this becomes really interesting, is even Western science suspected that we were, in fact, or that we are, in fact, related through a form of energy that touches our lives in each moment of each day up until 1887. In 1887, there was one experiment that was performed.
The ether,
to once and for all prove or disprove the existence of this web of energy, and while the experiment, I believe, is performed well, its interpretation, I think, is where we may have gotten ourselves into trouble.
Other people say the instruments they used way back then were not sensitive enough to detect it.
Well, it's for listeners that may not be familiar with this experiment. This is the very famous Michelson-Morley experiment performed in 1887 to settle the controversy that was raging even then, once and for all, as to whether or not there is this invisible link, this web that binds every particle of creation in a way that we were just beginning to understand then. So an experiment was designed, it was carried out well, and on the basis of the experiment, they said they couldn't detect the what they called the ether, this web, and therefore they believed it wasn't there. It's analogous to today, Laura, if we were to go outside and lick our finger, hold it up in the air, if we felt no wind against our finger, saying that there is no air around us. They were trying to detect the wind of the ether as it passed through the device. So from that moment on, for a little over 100 years now, our modern science, Western science, has journeyed onto a path that believes and comes from the point, the sense that we are discrete, non-related experiences in our world, independently carrying out our daily functions, while all at the same time simultaneously having the experiences we call life. And it is that very path that now is coming full circle, because the experiments based in that understanding are showing so many anomalies that the anomalies are overwhelming the traditions, and scientists have to say there's something else going on. And to make a long story very brief, that something, we'll never use the word ether again, probably. And
it's tainted, isn't it? Has too much baggage.
Yes, that something is now being called the quantum hologram, the mind of nature. And it is through the brilliant work of super string theorists such as Michio Kaku and former astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell that the theories and the mathematics are coming together to validate the stuff that this web is made of, that this hologram is made of, and the implications of what it means in our lives. And for me, that is a very powerful principle of unity in our world.
So there's scientific backing now to what was formerly called the ether. What are the experiments that are demonstrating that there is this substratum of stuff that's binding us all together?
Well, of course, there have always been a number of independent and isolated research and researchers and experiments in the last 100 years that whose work has pointed to the existence of this unseen force. Three that I've identified in the last 5 years, with what I believe sets them apart, is that they were carried out in accredited academic and scientific institutions by very well-known researchers and theorists. And as they've been published, as this work now has been published and accepted in the scientific journals, then we, for the first time, have the basis to build this understanding. So perhaps the first three, and this is in no particular order, but the first one of those experiments was actually done by a gentleman that was on loan to the United States from Moscow's Academy of Sciences. His name is Dr. Vladimir Popanon. And what Dr. Popanon found was that there is a field, a previously unrecognized field of energy that links human DNA with matter, with photons of light, particles of light. Almost universally, ancient texts and traditions say that what happens in our bodies actually has an effect on the world around us, and we've never had a way to quantify that. This experiment, known as the phantom DNA effect, actually demonstrated under laboratory conditions that human DNA, the DNA that lives in every cell of our bodies, has a direct effect on the matter outside of our bodies. And that is just such an outrageous thing to be able to say in scientific terms.
And it does it through photons of light, through this interaction on the ether?
What was actually the result of his experiment, he, just very briefly, I'd like to go through what his experiment was all about. Vladimir Popanon created a vacuum inside of what he called, it was just a tube, a closed tube. It took all the air out, creating what science acknowledges as a vacuum. And even in the vacuum, we know that there are particles of light, photons of light. So they measured how those light particles were arranged, and as they expected, they were completely random distribution of photons. Then they placed human DNA into that vacuum and once again measured the light to see if the DNA was in any way affected, or if the light was in any way affected by the DNA.
In what form was the DNA? Was it
a
cell?
It was from human human tissue. Human tissue was placed into
Was
scraping.
It alive?
It was alive. It was scrapings of human tissue that were alive.
Okay.
and that the DNA was intact. And to their amazement, what happened was that the light particles aligned themselves along the axes of the DNA in ways that that the researchers weren't expecting to see. So that's important. What was really interesting now is that when they took the DNA out of the experiment, when they removed the DNA from the vacuum tube, the alignment of the light, of the particles, remained intact. In other words, even though there was nothing in the vacuum to guide the pattern of the light, of the follicles, they still held to the pattern as if the DNA were there.
Ergo, the phantom DNA.
Phantom DNA effect.
Like
the question is, what was it that was holding the pattern of that DNA? What was it that linked them together? And interestingly enough, I mean, here these scientists are seeing one of the most amazing phenomenon linking human DNA to the physical world that we've seen. And the way they describe it, Laura, is they say that the photons behaved surprisingly and counterintuitively, is the way they put it.
Lovely.
So this was the first of the experiments. So what we can say from this, and their conclusions were that, just briefly and very quickly, that the DNA excited a previously undiscovered form of energy, and that form of energy was what was responsible for holding the phantom DNA in place, even though the DNA, or the photons in place, even though the DNA was no longer inside the tube.
And when they tried this with other substances, when they tried this with something non-DNA, then nothing, the photons still remained
to
in
the best
random
of my knowledge,
pattern.
To the best of my knowledge, this worked only with living tissue.
Okay.
So what we know and what their conclusions were is that the previously unrecognized form of energy had been excited. The key is the energy appeared to be everywhere at once, and this is going to be important in our discussions here. Everywhere at once, and the word for that is non-local, rather than the energy being generated in one place and transmitted to something else. Second experiment, particularly interesting, is done by the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. INSCOM is the acronym for the organization. It was done in 1993. And interestingly, this experiment, again, involved human DNA, and cells. Living cells were taken from the inside of a donor's mouth. They scraped white cells called leukocytes, just tissue, from the inside of a donor's mouth. And when I read this, I always like to think that it was a willing donor. I don't know. Sure.
I'm wondering if animal DNA or some other DNA had the same effect. Why, if it was just human, too, but anyway, go on.
Well, the reason that they chose a human, and you'll see why for the next part of the experiment, so they took DNA from the donor's mouth. They placed it into a device that could measure the DNA electrically. In other words, they were measuring the DNA's response. They were expecting the DNA to do something, and they believed they could measure it electrically.
Hmm.
So in the same building, they put the DNA in one room and the donor in another room in the same building, separated by hundreds of feet.
And we're going to have that response happen through the distance.
Well, they exposed the donor to what they called emotional stimulus. They showed him videos that were designed to elicit the emotional responses. And what they found was that when the donor would have a peak emotional experience in one room, his DNA in the other room was having the same experience. And when he was having an emotional dip, in the emotions, his emotions, the DNA was having the same.
It's like Cleve Baxter's experiment with plants.
Well, it is. What's important about this is where they went next with this experiment, because what they found was that there was no lag time. Laura, it wasn't like the donor had an experience and transmitted it to his DNA. The time was happening. It was happening simultaneously. So the military, being curious as they are, said, how far can we separate the donor and his cells and still have this experience continue? They stopped the experiments when they had reached a distance of 50 miles.
Wow.
50 miles between the donor and his cells, and when the donor would have his experience, the cells were having the experience in the same instant of time. There was no lag time. And the conclusions, the summaries from that experiment was that the cells were communicating with the donor through a previously unrecognized form of energy, appearing to already be present everywhere at once. Non-local is the word they used.
And that follows the rules of quantum physics.
Quantum physics.
This is not Newtonian physics. This is quantum physics.
Precisely. And that the energy that was at work was working beyond the bounds, outside the bounds of measured distance and time. This form of energy is not subject to time and distance as we know it today.
So this was the
second experiment.
We're also laying the groundwork for understanding ESP and metaphysical experiences here.
Well, Laura, this is so exciting. This is the subject of an entire new program we're doing entitled The Secret of Our Reflected Universe. Because what the ancients said is that we walk this earth in the presence of a mirror or a substance that shows to us what it is that we've become from within. And ESP, the mysteries of miraculous healings and Qigong, Reiki, yogic healing traditions, all of these become a little less mysterious when we consider the presence of a unified web of energy that now is being acknowledged by Western science.
You know, Bastyr College here, the naturopathic college for training doctors,
right,
is hosting a series with shamans. They're very interested in how did shamanistic healings work. They work on this principle. Mm-hmm. And some of the shamans we've talked to who are speaking there have been speaking at major institutions, medical institutions, colleges across the country. They're all very intrigued. And now we finally have the cause and effect in place through various scientific experiments like this. So it's very exciting to throw open the doors to the ancient wisdom through the lens of modern experimentation, isn't it?
Well, it is, Laura, and I think this is the value. You know, people have often asked me why I spend so much time exploring ancient texts and traditions and journeying into Tibet or Egypt or Bolivia or Peru or wherever it is.
There's lessons there we need to relearn.
For the temples, and what the ancients are very clear of is that there was a time in the history of humankind when, in their words, the wisdom of the heavens was given to the people of the earth, and that we understood these relationships. And over time, is that wisdom disintegrated through a series of events that we can now recognize in history, breaks in the lineage of wisdom. What we know is that the teachings that were given to the people of the earth then are not inconsistent with what science is finding now. What's different, however, is the language. Those ancient teachings were passed down in the language of 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 years ago, whereas modern science is finding the same principles in a language that is less than 500 years old. So when we find a way to reconcile those languages, if we can humble ourselves to allow for that bridge, I believe we empower ourselves to participate in the events of our lives in ways we're just beginning to understand. And that is a powerful principle of unity.
That is indeed. You mentioned three experiments. What was the third one?
Well, the third one, and again, I'll just be very brief, and mm-hmm. We go into much more detail in these, and you know, when we're doing this work live. So we're just skimming this now so that we can have these principles under our belts. The third one, a paper was released in 1993, Laura, and I think perhaps the title of this paper may help us to understand why we don't see more of this work in lay terms, in Time Magazine and Life and Newsweek, because this work is being divulged in very technical and very specific scientific circles. The title of the paper was called Local and Non-Local Effects of Coherent Heart Frequencies on Conformational Changes of DNA.
That's a mouthful.
It's a long sentence, very technical sounding, and again, human DNA is the key here because human DNA appears to be the link between the feelings in our bodies and the light of our world, or the photons, or the events of our world around us. And to make this experiment very brief, what researchers did was they took human placental DNA, so it's new new DNA from the tissue of human placentas, and they placed it into ionized water, and those vases into the hands of individuals who were trained in emotional self response. Emotional, the word I'm looking for has just escaped me. They were trained to manage emotional self-management. That's the word. They were trained in emotional self-management. So there were a series of people who had been trained to manage their rage and their joy and their ecstasies and their fears, and they could pretty much do it on demand. And what the scientists found was that in the presence of certain emotions, the actual shape, what they're calling the conformation, the shape of DNA changes in response to human emotion. Now, this is an outrageous thing for a researcher to be able to find, because it is the very shape of the human DNA, how tightly the strands are twisted or how loosely they are bound together, that appears to be linked to how much of that DNA is active. So what they found was that there were certain kinds of emotions that wound the DNA up very, very tightly and actually compressed it. And there were other emotions that loosened the DNA up to the point where it actually became separate strands of DNA. And they could see these strands under high magnification.
So there were more than the two strands, or the strands started
to unravel? No, there were two physical strands. Yeah. However, the physical strands, the degree to which those physical strands were wound as the double helix was directly affected by the quality of the emotion in the person that was holding that DNA.
And what did the loosened or more tightly wound strands of DNA, what affected that?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting.
Uh-huh.
Deep feelings of compassion and love and appreciation and gratitude were the feelings that relaxed the DNA to the point where, in some of the instances, they were actually two separate strands of DNA. They were no longer wound in the same way.
So they weren't bound by that wonderful helix.
Precisely.
Provision.
And the feelings of anger and rage and fearful emotions were the ones that just wound this DNA up very, very tightly. And when we put these three experiments together, I believe what we have is the foundation of a relationship. It's a picture, Laura, that says human emotion has a direct effect upon me, and DNA has a direct effect upon a field of energy that extends beyond our bodies. And in that way, we are in direct contact, direct communication with the events of our world, once again, in ways that we're just beginning to understand. And we call that field now, the field is being called the quantum hologram, and we haven't had that discussion yet. There's a whole thing going on with that right now.
A question about this DNA.
Yes.
When the DNA is wound more tightly, does that affect its functioning, what it can do?
Well, the answer appears to be yes. What we know, and this goes back to work that was, some of this work we reported on in Walking Between the Worlds in 1997, some of it was from the same researchers, as a matter of fact. What we know is that the human genetic code, we've always been told, Laura, that it was a fixed code, that we have what we have when we come into this world. There's certain codes that are enabled, certain codes that are disabled, and that's what we have in our lifetime. One of the mysteries in the life sciences has been why it is in humans that so much of the human genetic code appears to be disabled, why it appears to be turned off. In other words, if we have
the so-called junk DNA,
so-called junk or empty DNA, or even the amino acids, if we have 64 possible combinations of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen that we call our genetic code, why do we have only 20 amino acids? And to make, again, a long story very brief, what researchers have found is that there are qualities of emotion that we can hold in our bodies that affect the DNA in a way that enhances the functioning of the DNA. Mm-hmm. And the result is that people who have these qualities of emotion have tremendously enhanced immune systems, for example. Their cells regenerate quicker than cells, damaged cells, broken bones, for example, or skin lesions, will regenerate much quicker in the bodies of those who have the emotions of gratitude, appreciation, and love than those who have anger and fear in their bodies. Intuitively, it stands to reason. Now, for the first time, science is finding the mechanism that allows us to unfold, and that throws a whole new light on ancient texts and traditions who were focused in their way of inviting us to become compassionate, loving beings in our world, and in that way, make a change in our world, bring peace to our nations, and heal our bodies.
It starts with our emotions, and how we react to the world, and our will, consciousness, and then the ripple effect goes through
these various
other levels of being, and it's just fascinating. We are talking with Greg Braden. We'll continue just after this break. Again, his books include Walking Between the Worlds, that he's mentioned, Awakening to Zero Point, and as late as the Isaiah Effect, Decoding the Lost Science of Prayer and Prophecy. We also have a link to Greg's website where you can find out about his various lectures and workshops across the country and his trips as well. We'll be right back with Greg Braden. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.normally.com.
All interviews on The Laura Lee Show are available on audio cassette. For information, call 1-800-243-1438.
Changes within the earth are affecting your sleep patterns, relationships, the ability to regulate your immune system, and your perception of time. Join Greg Braden on a tour of the evidence from Earth's diminishing magnetic field and rising base frequency to ancient texts recounting similar events in human history. Now you can attend the presentation by Greg Braden in the privacy of your own home. Awakening to Zero Point, the video, a jam-packed 3.5-hour presentation on 2 video cassettes for $39.95. Call 1-800-243-1438.
A gold chain found in a 260 million year old chunk of coal. Anatomically modern human bones and footprints in 55 million year old rock. Those are just a few of the anomalies of human antiquity documented in the book, The Hidden History of the Human Race. The evidence that humanity goes back millions of years is both shocking and abundant. Find out how the Knowledge Filters author Michael Cremo and Richard Thompson call it works. Make up your own mind. Call and order yours today at 1-800-243-1438.
From 3000 BC onward, all the world's major civilizations had plank-built boats capable of sailing to America, says anthropologist Gunnar Thompson. And sail they did. American Discovery, The Real Story, is the most beautifully illustrated and complete and far-reaching compilation of the evidence for these fascinating voyages. Interested in ancient maps? Who isn't? Gunnar Thompson has breakthrough discoveries in his newest book, The Friar's Map, documenting all the ancient maps that depicted the Americas long before Columbus sailed here. In fact, Columbus probably made use of some of these maps. The Radio Bookstore has both Gunnar Thompson's books and a limited supply of his first book about Asian American voyages thousands of years ago. If you'd like your copy, call 1-800-243-1438. The Radio Bookstore is your only source for all three of Gunnar Thompson's books. Call 1-800-243-1438. Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We continue our conversation with Greg Braden, and by the way, he teaches his workshops around the country, and you might want to join in. Greg, is there a number to call? And also, we have a link to your website that details your newest workshop on the reflective universe. Phone number?
Certainly. The office number, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, is area code 504-6892. Again, that's 505-424-6892. The website has a listing of the schedule, all the events, multimedia events that we're doing throughout the world, as well as sacred journeys into many of the ancient temples where we've gleaned aspects of this information.
This is so exciting. You were describing this process that we're understanding of how how to activate our full potential in terms of how we live our life, our consciousness. And it seems that currently this potential has been lying dormant with the conditions that prevail in the world and our emotional states. But now we're finding we can really activate this and how this is all tied together, how we relate from ourselves to our DNA that supports our biology and this machine that we went through life with, this mind that we have to think with, to experience emotion with, and how it interacts with other minds, other beings through this ether, how we are bound. How we interact and change one another.
Precisely, Laura. And what makes this especially relevant, I believe, in our lives is although Western science believes much of this is new, and I really enjoy being on the panel discussions and in the presence of researchers who believe that these are all new discoveries. What I have to say to myself is it may be new in the language of Western science. However, the concepts certainly are very ancient and have been around for a very long time. And again, I think that's the value of going back and looking at some of the most lasting teachings that have carried down through generations and millennia to our time today, and look at the essence of those teachings. And this doesn't have to be technical. It doesn't have to be complex. Our Western language may make it sound that way, but what the ancients were saying essentially is that the world around us is nothing more, nothing less than a mirror, a reflection of what's happening within us. And now that Western science has found the mathematics and the principles that confirm that, it says that in those old teachings, when we become compassionate, loving, forgiving, understanding beings in our daily lives, we can fully expect our world, our nations, to mirror that back to us through peace and cooperation between nations and governments. And I think with the condition of what's happening in our schools and our communities and our families today, it certainly warrants investigating how these principles can apply in our lives.
I saw a 2020 or some news magazine television report recently. They're reporting on a gentleman who, by his own admission, should have had AIDS. And he doesn't. And he was going, why? I'm certainly exposing myself to it. I've just never developed it. He got a blood test. A biotech company determined that his particular genes afford him an immunity, a naturally occurring spontaneous immunity to AIDS. They found another gentleman, a friend of his, who also felt he should have had AIDS and never got it. And they're patenting his gene. And they are not, the point of the story was not that it occurs, but that they're patenting his gene, they're going to make a bunch of money on it, trying to make it into some, you know, immunity that they can then give you in a pill or a drug, and that also you can patent certain human DNA codes, which is so absurd, whole big ethical and moral issues on that. So my question is that perhaps there's a bigger secret than trying to transfer genes and do gene transfer to afford immunity. Maybe if you just live a better life or you look into some of these keys of emotional management and such, maybe your own DNA can, as you're implying, from the basis of some of these experiments that have gone on, can adapt and function optimally and then protect you from certain assaults in the environment.
Well, you know, Laura, it's
so
very interesting.
Maybe that's the secret. Maybe we all enhance our own DNA, if it's so changeable, on a daily basis. You talked in the past about children. Tell us about some of those experiments also with children who had some spontaneous DNA transmutations that were going on.
Well, all of this, all the things we're talking about point to a principle, and it's this principle, I believe, that really brings all of this to bear. It's the principle of unity that scientists today are calling the principle of the quantum hologram. And that's a very technical sounding term that simply says there is a fabric that weaves its way throughout every element of creation, every atom, every particle of every atom, every element of each rock and tree and plant and person, animals that we'll ever see, the walls of our homes and the material of our automobiles. We are all linked. All of those things are linked. This fabric that is called the quantum hologram. And scientists are going so far now, many researchers and some of the conferences I've been in recently, are going so far as to believe that it is within this hologram, Laura, that we may actually find the long-sought after definition of the human soul, of human consciousness, of the human mind, and of heavens, what the ancients referred to as the heavens. And the irony is that it is through our technology is advancing so quickly, to know how to apply our technology, we must find the answer to these questions, to know where to go next.
Yeah.
To know if when we clone a human body, for example, does that cloned being have a soul? And to know when we clone organs for transplant, are they going to be accepted or rejected by the body? And if so, how that relates on the holographic level. All of this comes back. Some of the first instances that we saw for this are the studies now that you're referring to in the HIV and the AIDS. Back in 1996 and 97, there was a study that was reported, and it was, from my understanding, it was one of the first global blood studies that was ever carried out. The purpose was to determine what was happening with the HIV virus, the epidemic that was sweeping the world. And we all remember back in the early 80s, when we first began hearing about AIDS, what researchers were saying was if someone tested positive, there was a 100% mortality rate for the HIV virus. It might take 10 to 14 years, and that would happen. Well, the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York City conducted a global blood study. And to their amazement, Laura, what they found was that a significant percentage of the human population had developed a genetic alteration in their blood. In other words, the DNA had mutated to the point where there was a natural immunity to the HIV virus that appeared to be spontaneously springing up in human populations. And what that said, for the first time, it said that the world is not going to end from AIDS because we now have a way through spontaneous genetic mutation. There is a way to defend from this. And they began studying the people who had these changes in their blood to see what was different about them.
And what was different about them?
Well, they actually found five genes that were common, genes that had elements that were activated, switches. You can think of these conceptions, little switches that are turned on in these people that were not turned on in the general population at large. And now the study is to find out what it is that's different about those people, and that the numbers have increased since that study in 1986. Now, I'm often asked, and I know you get the questions, about children, and we're hearing about new children coming into the world and the new capabilities, the super psychic children in China and the indigo children that were identified by various authors over the last few years. And this has not been a focus of my study per se, and it also comes into play with some of the earlier work that we found, because children were some of the first individuals found in the United States that had these alterations. UCLA reported a young boy, and what I'm about to share may have happened previously. This is the first time it was documented in the hospital. A young boy who was born HIV positive. His mother had HIV. He was born HIV positive, and they studied him and sampled his blood over the months and the years, and what they found was that by the time he was 4 years of age, the HIV virus, it wasn't that it was dormant in his body. It had disappeared altogether from his body. And this was the first time this had ever been seen in the human population. The reason this is important, and the reason it's important to know that those genetic mutations are possible, is because of the principle of the quantum hologram. What it says is that as we are all linked through this fabric of creation, if even one of us, Laura, has the capability within our body, within our consciousness, to create this change in our body, then we all have access to that capability.
This is the 100th monkey effect. When one monkey figures out to do something, they all figure out how to do it.
Well, the common theme, however, the link appears now to be this quality of human emotion. It appears that it is this quality of, for lack of a better term, in the Western language, the words that we call gratitude and appreciation and love. When we can embody those qualities of emotion, those waveforms, if you will, of emotion in our bodies, that it has an effect that the experiment showed us on the DNA, and that effect determines to some, at least to some degree, what switches or how efficiently our DNA is working, whether or not our immune system, our immune functions are fully enabled or not. We don't have to know any of that. It's just because we have learned to love and appreciate and find gratitude in the events of our lives.
For these individuals who, like this 4-year-old boy and some of these other individuals whose blood has been documented to contain DNA changes, were they more loving, compassionate, forgiving, warm individuals? Or did you see a personality difference?
Well, this is what's interesting. In the young boy, one of the reasons I think it's important is that young boy was too young between the time of his birth and his 4 years of age to have been indoctrinated into the patterns of anger and rage and hate that we see typically in adult populations. So there are researchers now that are speculating, and again, we don't know precisely how to measure this, but their sense is that in the innocence and in the joy of being a young child without those predisposed patterns of anger, that it is his joy of life that transcended his condition of a life-threatening disease.
Okay. Andrew Weil talks about why not study people who have spontaneously cured themselves of grave illness, spontaneous remissions, they call it. They don't know why they got better, but they did. And he went to them and interviewed many of them and said, let's look at how you did this. What's different about you? And he said all of them, these were adults, all of them, in a concerted, conscious effort, forgave themselves, forgave others in their lives of hurts. They looked at joy of life. They simplified their life. They spent more time doing loving simple things and made it an effort to do a makeover of their soul, of their life. And he said that's the one thing he found that they had in common.
Well,
so that would make sense.
And there have been other studies. And again, this is what's so exciting about those three experiments and the new research. We've been so hard-pressed to measure what this energy is. What we're doing is we're documenting the effects, the outcome. We haven't been able to really measure the energy. And what researchers found, many of the people, individuals now, who have transcended their HIV status, in other words, their HIV appears to be gone now, they asked them, they said, do you all use crystals? Do you wear crystal pendants? Or do you have a mantra that you speak every day, or do you drink a substance fermenting in the refrigerator when you first get up in the morning? And
in other words, what's your magic bullet?
Sure.
Right?
And while all of those things may be important paths for individuals to find their power, the common theme was that they changed their belief system.
Mm-hmm.
They had changed their belief system, and that belief, thought, feeling, and emotion is what makes our beliefs. That belief is what allowed their bodies to transcend the condition. When I come back briefly now to the hologram and that last experiment that we did where human DNA changed shape in the presence of the emotion, what the researchers found, and this is really key, I think, to what we're doing here, they said that human intentionality, this is a direct quote, human intentionality produced effects which defy conventional laws of electromagnetism. In other words, by having the intent of a feeling in our body, we're creating an effect in our body that works outside of the boundaries of measured time and space. They go on to say, and this is, I think, maybe the key to our whole discussion, that they believe they have now found a non-Hertzian field of quantum energy. It is definitely energy. And we are used to measuring energy in our scientific circles to what we call hertz. It's the number of pulses or cycles per second. And this form of energy doesn't work that way. It doesn't have to be generated in one place and then shipped somewhere else over a wire or broadcast through the air like a radio antenna. This form of energy appears to already be present everywhere at once, all of the time, and everywhere that this energy, in every location, this energy has the blueprint for all the possibilities of life. And that's a whole program unto itself right there.
And that's what the ancient Vedas, for example, describe as that substratum of life. It's all full potential. And then as things manifest out, or what David Bohm calls the implicate order as it goes into the explicate or the expressed order of matter.
Or Sheldrake's, Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenetic fields and how those fields relate to life. Now, for the first time, I believe that we're finding in a language that we're comfortable with, in the Western language, the way to actually go beyond describing. Now we're able to build devices that can measure this non-Hertzian field of energy, and this is the stuff, once again, that many researchers now believe is what consciousness is made out of and what our soul, it defines the soul of human existence. And the interesting thing is, Laura, that it is because of the technology that threatens our very existence that we have the tools to actually be able to define our existence in this world and know where to go with that technology as we move forward. And
the danger comes the blessing?
Yes, isn't that interesting? I mean, it's just fascinating.
Boy, it really is. So who are the scientists who are describing this non-Hertzian, and how are they measuring it? What instruments do they have?
Well, this is some of these, the human DNA experiments, for example, Glenn Ryan and Roland McCready. They're associated with the Institute of Heart Math.
Uh-huh. We've talked to them. Uh-huh.
Some of the major medical research institutions there in Northern California. Obviously, the Vladimir Popanon and the work that he's doing. They've all now been able to, they all have concluded that their experiments were dealing with a previously unrecognized form of energy that works beyond the bounds of time, distance, on a quantum level, and beyond the bounds of a Hertz, of a Hertzian measurement. And all of our machines have been built to measure Hertzian fields. That's why we haven't seen them. We've seen...
Because our machines measure one tiny slice of the whole entire spectrum.
Sure. Now...
Like our eyes see one tiny slice of the spectrum.
Well, this is... And again, this could probably be a whole program unto itself, but what we know is that the late 1800s, there was a tremendous spiritual revolution that was sweeping the earth, and it was mirrored in scientific principles. The ether was a part of that. And World War I came along and kind of...
Diverted our attention.
Flushed that revolution, and then World War II came along, and then the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the Cold War, and we're just now kind of peeking out from under the umbrella of either preparing for war or defending ourselves in war, and we go back and look at the research of people like Wilhelm Reif and Reich and John Keeley, George Delawar,
Nikola Tesla.
Every one of them had built devices that measure, detect, and measure and utilize this subtle form of energy. And now their work, they were ahead of their time and they're by about 100 years. And their work now is taking on new significance in the presence of these recent discoveries.
So when they were reporting effects that conventional science could not understand, and therefore they were labeled fringe nuts and set off to the side, now we can go back and dust off their experiments. And it's too bad that so many of their actual apparatus have been lost. I mean, people are still looking for, some of those.
Destroyed?
Yeah, So it would be really nice if we could just go to some museum and see the actual instruments. But I guess we'll have to reinvent them or just pick up on the clues or look. Or maybe, I think this is also something that the universe wants us to know. It's broadcasting it out, and we're now just picking up the signal. And I think we can go back to the source and find anew where it wants us to go. I think it is an interactive universe, and this is the way in which we co-create with it.
Well, to us it sounds like a long time ago, the late 1800s, in the relative scheme of human existence, it's still a very compressed time frame. Within 100 years, we've gone from believing that we are discrete, separate, non-related individuals that just happen to be sharing time in this world together, now to the point at the birth of our 21st century, where we're saying, wait a minute, it may be that what we do in one part of our world actually has an effect on people and on the conditions in another part of the world through a field that we've never acknowledged in the past. And
the rules have changed, therefore we can change how we go about our business of conducting our affairs in the world.
Well, I think at the very least, Laura, what we're finding, because each of these experiments was tied to human DNA, and human DNA now is linked directly to the code of conduct in how we live our lives each day. It brings it all right back to the personal responsibility and how we live our lives each day. At the very least, we can no longer discount the power of mass human emotion. When we come together in periods of joy, joyous prayer, for example, mass prayer, non-religious, non-denominational feelings of prayer, we can no longer discount those effects upon the events of our lives. And there certainly is some very good statistical evidence bearing this out.
And what is that statistical evidence?
Well, through what we now know, through the book, The Isaiah Effect, for example, we know that in a 2,500-year-old scroll, the first Old Testament prophet, Isaiah, in the language of his day, described a mode of prayer with no words, no outward expression. It's based in human feeling that he said could heal our bodies and bring about lasting peace in our world. That mode of prayer has been taught on the World Wide Web and has been utilized in mass vigils of prayer involving 85 nations and hundreds of thousands of people. And during what researchers call the window of the prayer, the time the prayer is happening, glitches in the peace treaty in Northern Ireland were overcome, for example, and the peace treaty was signed. During the window of that prayer, U.S. warplanes, NATO warplanes, turned around in mid-air on their way to bombing runs in Iraq in 1998 in what was noted as a rare stand-down order through the military after the planes had been deployed. We've seen healing conditions within the bodies of individuals during the windows of this prayer, and within 24 hours of a global prayer during the Kosovo crisis, NATO troops were in Kosovo, and researchers call these things coincidences. As a scientist, I would agree, except that the correlations are so high. The Israelis have done tremendous research with this in other organizations. In 25 Western cities in the early 1980s, they found that when a certain number of people can have these kinds of emotions in their body, that the world around them mirrors that. Crime statistics, violent crimes drop. Terrorist activities in the Middle East stop. Crimes against people, traffic accidents declined. And statistically, when the people stopped having these kinds of feelings, that all of those numbers reversed. And it happened to such a degree that there's actually a mathematic formula that shows that when the square root of 1% of a given population begins to live their lives in this way, that population will see the change. So because of those kinds of experiments, I say that this work certainly warrants further investigation, and we can no longer discount the power of our emotions in the events of our lives. When we feel helpless in global disasters and we see war breaking out a half a world away from us, and we say, what can we do? The quantum hologram says that it's part of all of us and there is something we can do. It's a subtle, although a very powerful effect that can only be realized when many people come together and share this very powerful field of emotion.
So Larry Dolphy documents or mentions all of the many experiments on the power of prayer, where one person praying for another's healing, even as the blind study on
you know, gouge the skin, and some group gets prayed for and some don't, and the group that gets prayed for, their wounds heal faster, for example. So that's an individual person-to-person effect. What you're talking about is you can just magnify that into a collective effect. If a group of people get together and pray, and you're going to talk about this mode of prayer in a moment, then they can actually impact the events of the world around them.
Well, they could participate in how those events are unfolding. It's not a magic bullet that says we can go out and change the world.
No, because there's too many consciousnesses in the soup to have any one group dominate it. Yeah.
What the statistics have found, the square root of 1% of a given population, those numbers are so small. In a city of a million people, for example, that number is about 100 people. And in a world of 6.2 billion people, that number is about 8,000 people. And those numbers seem, people say, well, it can't be that easy. And the ancient traditions say, why would we make it any more difficult than that? I mean, the more people that participate, the more accelerated the effects, of course. And there is a threshold where when a minimum number of people join together, and it's more than just saying, dear God, please let these things happen.
Talk about the mode of prayer that you found to be the most effective.
Well, it is based in precisely what these experiments are saying. It's based in human feeling, and very briefly, in inviting us to feel as in our hearts, to feel the feeling and give thanks as if the prayer has already come to pass, rather than feeling the anxiety and asking that the prayer be answered. So in other words, instead of saying, dear God, please let there be peace in the world, or let there be healing in my body, and feeling the anxiety associated with it because it's not there.
So you project yourself into the future. If you want a more loving world, then feel love and compassion.
And Mother Teresa was a master at this, giving thanks for the peace and the healing that has already occurred, and in that way, perpetuating greater amounts of peace and healing through the principles of the quantum hologram. We now understand precisely how those kinds of feelings could work. And the three experiments are saying that not only do they affect the world inside of our bodies, they affect the world outside of our bodies as well.
What a fascinating world we live in, and to understand the subtleties of how it all works and how we participate and what our full potential is and how easy it is actually to unfold that is very exciting and rewarding, Greg. So thanks for all that you do.
Well, thank you for being such a gracious host. As always, I enjoy your program very much.
We have a link to Greg's website where you can see the details of the many lectures and workshops that he gives around the country. He also takes people on journeys to Tibet, to Egypt, to Peru, various magical journeys to experience some of this ancient wisdom up close and personal. Greg's books include The Isaiah Effect, Walking Between the Worlds, and Awakening to Zero Point, all available at the radio bookstore. Thanks so much for listening. That was Greg Braden, and I'm Lou Lee.